years. In 1999, astronomers predicted that the solar system would slowly fall apart over a period of at least a billion, that is 10 to the power 18, or a quintillion years. They calculated that's how long it would take for orbital resonances from Jupiter and Saturn to decouple Uranus. According to Zink's team, though, this calculation left out some important influences that could disrupt the solar system much sooner. Firstly, there's the Sun. In about 5 billion years, as it dies, the Sun will swell up into a red giant, engulfing Mercury, Venus, and even Earth. Then it will eject nearly half its mass, blown away into space on stellar winds. The remaining white dwarf will be around just 54% of the current solar mass. This mass loss will loosen the Sun's gravitational grip on the remaining planets. Mars and the outer planets and ice giants, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. Secondly, the solar system orbits the galactic center. Other stars ought to come close enough to perturb the planet's orbits, around once every 23 million years. The researchers wrote, "By accounting for stellar mass loss and the inflation of the outer planet orbits, these encounters will become more influential," adding, "Given enough time, some of these flybys will come close enough to dissociate or destabilize the remaining planets." With these additional influences accounted for in their calculations, the team ran the 10 n-body simulations for the outer planets, leaving out Mars to save on computation costs since its influence should be negligible, using the powerful Shared Hoffman 2 cluster. These simulations were split into two phases, up to the end of the Sun's mass loss and a phase that comes afterwards. Although 10 simulations isn't a strong statistical sample, the team found that a similar scenario played out each time. After the Sun completes its evolution into a white dwarf, the outer planets have a larger orbit but still remain relatively stable. However, Jupiter and Saturn become captured in a stable 5-2 resonance. For every 5 times Jupiter orbits the Sun, Saturn orbits twice. That eventual resonance has been proposed many times, not least by Isaac Newton himself. These expanded orbits, as well as characteristics of the planetary resonance, make the system more susceptible to perturbations by passing stars. After 30 billion years, such stellar perturbations jangle those stable orbits into chaotic ones, resulting in rapid planet loss. All but one planet escape these orbits, fleeing off into the galaxy as rogue planets. The last lonely planet sticks around for another 50 billion years, but its fate is sealed. Eventually, it too is knocked loose by the gravitational influence of passing stars. Ultimately, by 100 billion years after the Sun turns into a white dwarf, the solar system is no more. That's a significantly shorter time frame than that proposed back in 1999. And researchers carefully note it's contingent on current observations of the local galactic environment and stellar flyby estimates, both of which may change. So it's by no means engraved in stone. However, even if the estimates of the timeline of the solar system's demise do change, it's still many billions of years away. The likelihood of humanity surviving long enough to see it is very slim. aperture.
Depleted uranium made a spectacular entrance on the battlefront in 1991. During the first Persian Gulf War, bombs and shells made with this high-density metal annihilated Saddam Hussein's tanks. And since then, the U.S. military have regarded depleted uranium munitions as the magic weapon. For those who use it, depleted uranium is beyond reproach. But others say it is a deadly poison. So who's right and who's wrong? Many countries possess weapons based on depleted uranium, and experimentation has been rife. But the consequences for civilians and the military alike have been dramatic. Today's documentary, Depleted Uranium, a Very Presentable Killer, compares and contrasts the arguments of those who defend and attack a technology that is highly toxic. Stay with us for the first part.
It's a wonderful weapon. Depleted uranium is a very dense, hard metal. And you put it on the end of a bullet, or you put it on the end of a shell, and it'll go through a tank and go through the second tank. I mean, it's wonderful from a military standpoint.
Based on the fact that certain armies around the world are developing new armor plating capabilities, which can't be pierced other than by depleted uranium munitions, it's quite normal to conserve a high-level operational capability that the French army envisages equipping its Leclerc tanks with this type of munitions.
I was trying to say, hey guys, you may be creating a problem. I have been very careful not to accuse, because you know, j'accuse is a pretty strong thing to say to somebody.
My name is Jacques Charmelot. I've been a journalist for 30 years. I've covered conflicts in Africa, Iran, Lebanon, Iraq, and in the Balkans. And I've worked in Washington, a secret and powerful city. On July the 4th, 2012, I'm in America's federal capital. I'm in the crowd attending the Independence Day parade. But my thoughts are elsewhere. I'm back from a battleground that the American soldiers have just left, Iraq. Barack Obama has put an end to more than 20 years of war-torn confrontation between the US and this distant country. But what I saw there is indelibly etched on my memory. Depleted uranium begins in Iraq. Iraq has been subjected to more than 50 years of revolutions, dictatorships, and wars. And it's trying with all its might to be reborn. But its poisoned past weighs heavy on the fate of 30 million Iraqi citizens. My investigation begins in Basra, a huge port caught between Iran, Kuwait, and Saudi Arabia. In February 1991, it is at the heart of the international offensive to drive Saddam Hussein out of Kuwait. Iraqi tanks want to leave the small emirate, but American planes, masters of guise, are waiting for them. I head for the scene of the Iraqi rout.
I took part in the war in Kuwait against the American forces.
Could you tell us about leaving Kuwait? How it happened for you?
I fought in the war up to the very end until the Iraqi army retreated, but it wasn't so much a retreat as every man for himself. The road was exposed and the planes bombarded our military forces. That was the situation with our tanks. The road was open and straight, and it was very easy for the Americans to bomb our tanks. It was this, the road of death.
The final battle in the war lasted just 10 hours. Hundreds of tanks and vehicles were blown into shreds and abandoned in the desert. Much later, an official American document explains why the success was so devastating. On the road of death, American pilots used a newcomer to their weaponry arsenal. They fired thousands of rounds containing at least 320 tons of depleted uranium. The rounds are equipped with a depleted uranium arrowhead penetrator, which can pierce any armor plating. They catch fire on impact, reaching over 1,000 degrees, igniting the target and emitting a cloud of fine dust. They are real tank killers. Four countries are the main producers: the United States, Russia, China, and France. Natural uranium is used in numerous countries. Once enriched, it becomes highly radioactive and is used in atomic weapons and nuclear power stations. The residue of the enrichment process is called depleted uranium. It is weakly radioactive, but is not degradable. It has to be securely stored or recycled. 50,000 tons are produced around the world every year. In Basra, depleted uranium is accused of leaving a terrible legacy. I head for the city's central hospital.
Are you being treated?
Yes, I'm still being treated. Until God takes my soul. They diagnosed cancer in my pancreas and then my liver. You know, the countries that started the wars don't come to help us. They poured their poison on us and then they went away.
In 1991, the first Gulf War started. And at that time, I was here on a duty at night duty, when the airplanes, fighters, and bombs. After that, by many years, 3 or 4 years, we start to see many cases of cancer, particularly in this hospital. If we compare it to the 80s or 90s, we found there is an increase of, say, fourfold. 1996, somebody came here with a delegation, escorting a delegation. He's from the security. And he knows about the problem. And he told me, "Doctor, you know that we are under the effects of depleted uranium, which is used by the American." Yeah, he just whispered into my ear that we got this problem. And so we start to have a link between the use of depleted uranium and the increased cancer rates. You know, now we have what we call a cancer phobia here among people. Everybody who got a mass, they think that he got a cancer.
Even before Dr. Jawad Al-Ali learnt about the dangers of depleted uranium, in 1995, the Americans produced a film alerting its own soldiers to the risks involved with the heavy metal.
Battlefields and fighting are by nature hazardous to your health. Some hazards are easy to identify and well understood. Soldiers recognize the serious hazards presented by incoming artillery shells and bullets and take appropriate actions. However, some lesser hazards from new technological applications are not so well known and recognized. One of these newer applications is the use of depleted uranium in munitions and equipment armor.
The film fixes three safety rules for dealing with potential depleted uranium contamination. Get away as far as possible, as quickly as possible, and avoid any exposure to the skin. Three rules that were impossible to respect in Basra. I discover one of the tank cemeteries that abound throughout the city. There are thousands of tons of debris, some of which contaminated by depleted uranium dust, have been accessible to the population here for 20 years. I'll ask the head of the Environment Ministry why such dangerous metal wasn't removed to safety.
After 1991, we had a full report on the sites and their effects. There was no department to deal with it. Every time we found a piece of contaminated metal, we identified it with a red or yellow tag. Before 2003, we put a notice, danger, contaminated fragment, do not approach. Shortly after, we'd return to the same place and the notices would have disappeared and we'd find them somewhere else. Even if we deemed it important at the time, it was only relatively important, as the situation was very complex and local authorities had other concerns. Why did the Americans from 2003 and even since 1991 not remove or displace the metal waste? They did nothing at the time. The likely reason, in my view, is that they hadn't yet measured the effects of using this weaponry. They wanted to see the results and the effects after 5, 10, and 15 years, etc. God will decide. But the munitions they used against us will have effects on our children, our grandchildren, and our great-grandchildren for generations to come, probably until the end of time.
During the invasion of Kuwait, Paris was a faithful ally of the USA, and French troops played a crucial role. I contact journalist Marie-Claude Dubin, who was at the front line.
There was a tank which looked all burnt up. And I said, can I go inside? It's not mine. No, it's not mine, you can go in. I raised up clouds of dust, and I never imagined that the ashes were mixed with depleted uranium dust.
What illness are you suffering from?
An autoimmune disease. I've been told it attacks the nerves, muscles, the thyroid, plus certain neurocognitive problems, neuromuscular lesions.
To get a clearer picture of what happened to Marie-Claude Dubin and to patients in the Basra Hospital, I go to Valence to see a scientist. For years, Roland Desbordes has been speaking out against the risks of depleted uranium. He's the president of CRIRAD.
We know that depleted uranium is pyrophoric, which means that it ignites spontaneously in the air, with the oxygen in the air. A flameless combustion, but with oxidization, producing uranium oxide, which is an extremely fine dust that's released into the air. You can then be contaminated internally, either through inhalation, if you're not wearing a mask, or by ingestion, because it'll be on your fingers. The uranium combines many risks, but why? Because it's an alpha emitter, and alpha radiation is what causes the most internal damage. Secondly, because it's a heavy metal, and we retain it. It metabolizes within the organism for many long years. For it to lose half its radioactivity, it takes 4.5 billion years.
4.5 billion years is the same age as planet Earth. These concerns over the harmful effects of depleted uranium dust are shared by official scientific bodies.
The problem is, in the case of internal contamination, either you ingest it because you're in a contaminated environment and it can be found in the water and in food, or you inhale and the particles of depleted uranium reach your lungs. There are two phases to this. Firstly, the uranium particles have to be dissolved to get into the blood, and once they're in the bloodstream, they'll be distributed among the various organs. Once in the organs, either it builds up or it doesn't.
We often refer to the case of the Iraqi children who play in the tanks that were destroyed and who collect the scrap metal and cut it up, or housewives who sometimes recycle the metal to make pots that they'll subsequently cook in. Do you think there's a risk?
There are potential effects, especially if there's repeated exposure, even if it's not chronic. And this will be the case. Children come to play, water is cooked in the pots. With ingestion, with repeated administration within the body, even if you only have weak doses, The fact of accumulating the various doses can ultimately have an effect on health.
Clearly, the depleted uranium dust falls down and it settles.
Yes. Once it falls, obviously the ground will be contaminated. Afterwards, it depends on how this contamination comes about, if it's very localized or not, and whether it's in towns or in fields which will be cultivated. So there will definitely be a contamination of the environment.
Things are becoming clearer to me, and more worrying. The depleted uranium particles are dangerous for health and for nature. The career of depleted uranium munitions began in Iraq, but it continued in the heart of Europe, just a few hours by air from capital cities like Paris, Rome, and Berlin. I walk among the graves in the Jewish cemetery in Sarajevo. It was from here that Serbian snipers kept the besieged city locked down. The journalists, who like myself, came to cover the conflict, often found themselves behind the yellow walls of the Holiday Inn. In 1992, divisions in Yugoslavia forced Bosnia into a war. In April, the inhabitants of Sarajevo were trapped. The UN launched an impossible mission to reconcile Muslims, Serbs, and Croats. But the war dragged on, and in 1995, NATO intervened. NATO planes, mostly American, bombed the Serbs, who were forced to make peace. The Sniper Alley tramway takes me to Hadići, a suburb on the outskirts of Sarajevo. I enter a ruined factory, a key element in the Serbs' military industry. Tanks and cannons were repaired here. NATO planes attacked the Hadići factory 7 times in September 1995. And fired more than 4,000 depleted uranium shells. When peace was reinstated, many Serbs from Hadići moved to Bratunac, a Serbian republic town in eastern Bosnia. They went there to live and also to die. Nedeljko Zelenović is a journalist and a witness. He has investigated the NATO bombings. His father, uncle, cousins, and dozens of friends worked in the Hadići factory.
All the workers who worked on the assembly lines at the time, who were caught in the fighting, and later at the time I was following events, they all died from various forms of cancer. In 1996, the population of Bratunac was between 20 and 22,000 people. And less than 5% of them came from Hadići. That year, in 1996, 154 people were buried in the Bratunac Municipal Cemetery. 3% of them came from Hadići. But in 2000, 105 people were buried in Bratunac, and 50% of them came from Hadići. I have a few names if you're interested.
Jerić Budimir, Andrić Drago, Mastilo Dušan, Banduka Milinko, Banduka Danilo, Aleksić Nenad, Makajić Simo, Stanojević Relja, Puša Ramon, Trutaš Ljubica, Lavušić Mostar.
What did your son die of?
He was diagnosed with leukemia. I asked what it was caused by. And they told me it was due to depleted uranium.
Mehmed Telalevich is a Muslim. During the war, he fled Hadiçi, driven out by the Serbs. In 1996, he returned home, close to the ruins of the arms factory. He found his house, blown apart by bombs. Mehmed rebuilt it, not suspecting that the land around it had been contaminated by poisonous dust.
We were never told. Nobody ever said anything. The public at large can't even be aware of it, as this disease is really a lottery. You put up with it, you fight it, and you might live or die. I know at least 10 people here, all young, aged between 35 and 40. They all have a cancer.
Mehmet tells me that he discovered he had colon cancer in 2004. He's taken chemotherapy and is now in remission. But the news is not good. The latest tests revealed that his prostate is 4 times bigger than normal. He has blood in his urine.
I've become fragile. Before, I could take normal showers. But now I have to have very, very hot showers. I have to wear leggings. I'm cold all the time. I'm delicate. My blood is anemic. I've no immunity.
Are you sure all this is because of the factory?
Oh yes, I'm 100% certain. There are no other diseases here apart from cancer.
I pursue the depleted uranium trail in Italy. A great ally of the USA within NATO, the country organized humanitarian missions in Bosnia. It later sent a strong contingent to separate Serbs and Albanians in Kosovo. And it was in Italy that the dangers of depleted uranium weapons were widely exposed in late 1999. In Rome, I meet another Italian soldier who'd been sent to the Balkans. Colonel Americo Lacetti.
So it began in 1999.
I came back in 1999, and on December 24th, I had an X-ray. I remember I was alone with the technician. There was nobody at the hospital. When I asked him what I had, he said, "What have you got?" And then he said, "Enjoy Christmas, because you won't be here next year." I had this lump 24 centimeters long, 14 centimeters wide, and 12 centimeters thick, a tumor in my lungs. After that, I had other tests, and they took a piece of the tumor and examined it. Inside were numerous ceramic particles, perfectly round. And they contained a load of substances that don't exist naturally. But they do exist when a depleted uranium projectile strikes a hard surface. This produces a cloud of dust, which when you inhale it, creates this type of pathology. I'm now living in a body that's mined.
As the death toll builds in Italy, the public is outraged, and the government has to act. On January the 3rd, 2001, the Prime Minister, Giuliano Amato, breaks the official silence and announces that he is going to demand a full account from NATO. But this demand will have little effect.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Thank you.
IRIB English Radio, with you every single moment.
In the limelight.
The United States saw the most new coronavirus cases of the pandemic on Thursday, 3rd of December, with deaths and hospitalizations also rising. Underlying conditions largely determine who survives. The United States is winding up a particularly devastating week, one of the very worst since the coronavirus pandemic began 9 months ago. On Thursday, 3rd of December, a national single-day record was set, with more than 217,000 new cases of coronavirus infections. It was one of the many data points that illustrated the depth and spread of a virus that has killed more than 278,000 people in this country, more than the entire population of Lubbock, Texas, or Modesto, California, or Jersey City, New Jersey. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Manny Fernandez, Julie Bosman, Amy Harmon, Daniel Ivory, and Mitch Smith. The piece is titled, "The Virus is Devastating the U.S. and Leaving an Uneven Toll." United States is winding up a particularly devastating week, one of the very worst since the coronavirus pandemic began 9 months ago. On Thursday, 3rd of December, a national single-day record was set, with more than 217,000 new cases of coronavirus infection. It was one of the many data points that illustrated the depth and the spread of a virus that has killed more than 278,000 people in this country, more than the entire population of Lubbock, Texas, or Modesto, California, or Jersey City, New Jersey. "It's just an astonishing number," said Caitlin Rivers, a senior scholar at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security. Caitlin Rivers added, "We're in the middle of this really severe wave, and I think we go through the day-to-day of this pandemic, it can be easy to lose sight of how massive and how deep the tragedy is." In California, where daily cases reports have tripled in the last month, Governor Gavin Newsom announced a new round of regional stay-at-home orders to address a mounting crisis over intensive care beds in California. Some counties in the California Bay Area said they were enacting tough new restrictions this weekend before the state rules come into effect. And in South Florida, which is in the early stages of a new surge, physicians and politicians alike worried that there might not be enough resources to treat the sick. As the coronavirus has spread, infectious disease experts have gained a better understanding of who among the nation's nearly 330 million residents is the most vulnerable. Nursing home deaths have consistently represented about 40% of the country's COVID-19 deaths since midsummer, even as facilities kept visitors away and took other precautions, and as the share of the infections related to the long-term care facilities fell substantially. Underlying conditions play a pivotal role in determining who survives the coronavirus. Americans who have conditions like diabetes, hypertension, and obesity, about 45% of the total population, are more vulnerable to coronavirus infection. And new evidence has emerged that people in lower-income neighborhoods experience higher exposure risk to the virus because of their need to work outside the home. "The pandemic is us," said Andrew Neumer, an associate professor of public health at the University of California at Irvine, who added that part of the word pandemic derives from demos, ancient Greek for people. It's the same word that gives us demography or epidemic. The pandemic is collectively all of our actions. Upticks on both coasts have more than upset the progress in the upper Midwest, where new cases have started to fall. Some places in the Northeast are now reporting more cases each day than they were in the spring, in part because testing was limited then. Rhode Island is averaging more than 1,000 cases a day for the first time. In New York State, cases have reached record levels around Buffalo and Rochester, with no signs of slowing down. More questions than answers remain about the coronavirus and which people it kills and why. There has been no modern pandemic of this scale and sort for infectious disease experts and public health officials to draw from. As with cancer or even the common cold, no one has solved all of COVID-19's many mysteries. You may be a person with cancer who gets exposed to very little virus, and you're going to get a severe presentation, said Dr. Louis Ostrowski, an expert in infectious diseases at McGovern Medical School at the University of Texas Health Science Center at Houston, Texas. But you may be a young person without comorbidities who gets a massive exposure to the virus, and you may get a severe presentation as well. Months ago, there was a notion that the virus was a big city phenomena, as New York, Detroit, New Orleans, and other urban centers were hard hit. It has become clear now that this is no longer true, if it ever was. The virus has torn through places on the southwestern border with Mexico, where cases are spiking around Nogales, Arizona, and up on the northern border with Canada, too, where the Rosso, Minnesota area has set records. Los Angeles, California, and Miami, Florida are current hotspots, but so are Zeebach County in South Dakota and Des Smith County in Texas. Poor in particular have been more at risk than the rich, according to analyses of those who have been sickened by the virus and succumbed to it. And new studies have suggested that the reason the coronavirus has affected Black and Latino communities more than white neighborhoods is tied to social and environmental factors, not any innate vulnerability. According to one recent study of cell phone data, people in lower-income neighborhoods experienced significantly higher exposure risk to the coronavirus because they were compelled to go to jobs outside of their homes. Through early May, the number of people in the most affluent neighborhoods who stayed home all day increased by 27 percentage points, while the number in the lowest income areas increased by 11 percentage points, according to an analysis by social epidemiologist at Boston University School of Public Health. Neighborhoods matter, said Molly Scannell Bryan, a research associate professor at the Institute for Minority Health Research at the University of Illinois at Chicago. In Chicago, both your race and the race of your neighborhood affected where high death rates were. Men are dying from the coronavirus at higher rates than women, data has shown. Some researchers suggest that one explanation is that men are generally in poorer health than women, more likely to smoke or have heart disease. By early December, at least 135,000 men had died from the coronavirus infection in the United States, compared with at least 114,000 women, according to federal data. There are differences by state and by city, however. Women are more likely than men to die of the virus in Connecticut, but men are more likely than women to die in Arizona, New Jersey, and the District of Columbia, according to research from the Gender Sci Lab at Harvard University, which created a tracker on gender disparities related to COVID-19. One of the key at-risk demographics is older Americans who live in nursing homes and similar facilities. More than 787,000 residents and employees of at least 28,000 nursing homes and long-term care centers for older people in the United States have contracted the coronavirus, according to a New York Times analysis based on federal, state, local, and facility-level data. Of those infected, more than 106,000 have perished. The coronavirus is known to be particularly lethal to those in their 60s and older who have underlying health conditions, and it can spread easily through congregate facilities where many people live in a confined environment and workers move from room to room.
Around the World with Reporters.
Iran's Minister of Foreign Affairs, Javad Zarif, attended the sixth edition of the Rome-Med Mediterranean Dialogues Conference, which is being held in a digital format from November 25 to December 4. This year, the initiative, promoted by the Italian Ministry of Foreign Affairs and by ISPI, the Italian Institute for International Political Studies, has been focused on the topic Beyond COVID-19, Navigating Solutions for Post-Pandemic Times, featuring over 100 experts and political leaders. In his address, Zarif touched upon a number of issues of international relevance, spurred on by questions from Eli Gerenmayer from the European Council of Foreign Relations and Paolo Magri, Executive Vice President of ISPI, the top diplomat opened with an update on the coronavirus crisis in Iran.
The situation in Iran is pretty bad. Unfortunately, we're suffering from something more than the rest of the world is, and that is an economic war. This is way beyond restriction. The United States even prevents us from using our own money in different countries to pay COVAX for the vaccine. If they say otherwise, they're simply lying.
Later, the discussion shifted on the nuclear deal signed in Vienna in 2015.
Earlier this week, some of Europe's leading diplomats urged the members of the E3, France, Germany and the UK, to act quickly to set out a roadmap for Iran and the US to return to compliance with the JCPOA. There's a real risk, experts say, that the efforts can be disrupted by those forces who have been working hard to escalate tensions between Tehran and Washington.
The Europeans have not been able to implement their part of the deal. The Europeans say that we are in full compliance. They're simply not. Implementation compliance means that they have to have effects for these actions. And we don't see an effect. We don't see any European company in Iran. We do not see any European country buying oil from Iran.
Zarif also commented on the assassination in a terrorist attack near the Iranian capital Tehran of prominent nuclear physicist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. The future of the Iran nuclear deal will also be discussed with the European Union High Representative for Foreign Affairs, Josep Borrell, on Friday, the final day of the conference. Max Civili, Rome.
The fallout from the British government's decision to begin mass COVID-19 vaccination next week continues. The EU is certainly not happy about the move, and comments made by a government minister on London's LBC radio have only fueled the flames.
We've obviously got the best medical regulators, much better than the French have, much better than the Belgians have, much better than the Americans have. That doesn't surprise me at all, because we're a much better country.
The head of the European Commission's media service has been responding.
We are definitely not in the game of comparing regulators across countries, nor on commenting on claims as to who is better. This is not a football competition. We are talking about the life and the health of people.
The British Education Secretary's remarks haven't gone down well either with members of the public we have been speaking to in Brussels.
It's ridiculous and stupid, and it's not worthy at all. So why they want to put in confrontation with the EU authorities? So it's just to provoke more tension among the population or what?
The EU's regulator for vaccines is the European Medicines Agency. It wanted the UK to wait for its approval, given that Britain is still bound by the Brexit transition period. Authorities in Berlin are pointing out the vaccine that will be rolled out in the UK was developed by German firm BioNTech, using EU research funding, and is being produced in Belgium. Citizens we have been talking to believe the British government is trying to make up for its disastrous handling of the pandemic.
Now to do this step, to be kind of the first to do it, so I don't think that it's well thought through either. It's just, maybe it's like a PR move, it's a move from the government to show, yeah, we have it under control, but in the end, I don't know.
EU Health Commissioner Stella Kariakides says the delay in approving the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine is about winning the public's trust so that they actually take the jab.
The European Medicines Agency says it will make a decision on the authorization of the Pfizer vaccine by the 29th of December at the latest. But is this bolstering the EU's credibility in the eyes of citizens or eroding it? Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Turkish Health Minister Fahrettin Koca announced that Turkey will start distributing coronavirus vaccine after December 11. The minister said the Chinese vaccine, which Turkey had already made a deal to receive, will be given to all citizens in four-phase scheme. The first phase will include health workers and senior citizens, as well as people with disabilities. The second phase will cover those with the crucial and necessary jobs and citizens with chronic diseases.
We will be delivered at least 10 million doses of the vaccine in December, and this could go up to 20 million. Another 20 million doses will be supplied in January and 10 million in February. We want to increase these numbers.
Turkey made an agreement with China earlier to purchase 50 million vaccine doses. Turkey will be among the first countries in the world to begin vaccinating people for the coronavirus, with the first shipment of vaccines it has purchased to arrive in Ankara sometime after December 11.
I won't take the vaccine because I do not trust the results and it's not made in Turkey. I think they need to do more testing before giving it to citizens.
This comes as others cannot wait to get it.
Of course I will take the vaccine. I trust our government and its decisions. I'm tired of this whole corona thing.
Turkish president announced Monday a series of measures and restrictions to reduce the number of infections, such as imposing a daily curfew that starts at 9 p.m. and ends at 5 a.m., as well as a total lockdown during the weekend. Citizens and business owners argue that the closure and lockdown measures are affecting the economy.
We are abiding by all the rules, wearing masks and observing social distance while these closures affecting our business. Turkey's economy is already in a bad shape, and now with the new restrictions, things will get even worse.
Meanwhile, main opposition leader Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu criticized government's way of handling the coronavirus crisis, saying the measures taken by the government negatively affected the economy, as well as harmed medium and small businesses. He also accused the government of lying about infected and death toll numbers. Rehşan Saglam, Istanbul.
The French government has launched a new wave of measures in their effort to combat so-called Islamist separatism. 76 mosques up and down the country have been flagged as potential hotspots where extremist ideologies are being peddled.
There are a few mosques which are against the French Republic, where the imam is already being followed by the security services. Places where the teachings are against male and female equality. There's a hatred of Jews and Christians, a hatred of France. They have suspicious foreign financing. People there make excuses for terrorism. From today, we will begin our investigations to remove any doubts. But if our suspicions are confirmed, we will close these mosques down.
Darmanin also announced the deportation of 66 undocumented migrants suspected of radicalization. In the past few weeks, France has enforced the closure of the Muslim charity Baraka City, as well as the civil rights group, the Collective Against Islamophobia in France. Amnesty International described the move as shocking, with a chilling effect on all groups trying to battle racism. The latest measures come after a series of terror attacks that have killed a number of civilians. However, many Muslims believe there is a sense of collective punishment. France is home to the largest Muslim community in Europe, but issues over Islamophobia and racism have meant the large minority can struggle with social mobility. Such issues have been exacerbated by politicians. President Emmanuel Macron came under significant criticism when he described the religion of Islam as being in crisis across the world. Interior Minister Gerald Darmanin has also used language such as enemy within. The government have also thrown their weight behind blasphemous cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad, while cracking down on criticism of Zionist ideologies as anti-Semitic.
The unequal gap between America's rich and poor keeps widening at a record pace. Last month was the best November ever for stocks. Yet across Main Street, a once-in-a-century economic depression is being widely documented. While about half of U.S. retirees do rely on a 401k plan, which includes some stock ownership, the richest 10% of Americans own nearly 90% of all stocks. Since the start of the coronavirus lockdowns, the top 10 U.S. billionaires have now increased their wealth by 42%, or $127 billion. That eight-month increase is greater than the annual GDP of more than 130 nations. As much as the nation's ongoing police brutality problems or current presidential election confusion, economic inequality has been a major driver of this year's unprecedented political protest.
We had to fight for an eight-hour workday, and that involved people dying, violence in the street, for that to happen. And it happened here in Chicago, of all places. The history of unions have been fighting for working people, and not just the people who are in unions, but working people of all historical backgrounds. So that means civil rights, that means women's movements, and that also means improving the quality of our lives on an economic basis.
Data this week from the Workers' Union-linked Economic Policy Institute revealed that from 1979 to 2019, the income of the richest 0.1% has risen 345%. Over that same time period, the lower 90% of society has only seen a 26% increase, which is not close to covering the accumulated inflation. Since 1979, so-called trickle-down or neoliberal economics, which prioritizes corporations, slashes the role of government, and neuters the power of workers' unions, has completely dominated the nation's two-party system.
In the neoliberal era, you've had two parties that have been advocates of big business, with a very different subtle change on like social ideas and on and how quickly they act on big business. There might be the Democrats might be more subtle of their attacks on working people than the Republicans, but still there, right?
In 2019, the United States had the worst income inequality among not just all very developed nations, but across the entire West, excepting only Bulgaria. The economic catastrophe of 2020 will push the world's richest nation even further down that list. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
On December 2, 2016, the Federal High Court in Abuja handed down its ruling ordering the release of Sheikh Ibrahim Al-Zazaki and his wife Zinat. The court ruled that the arrest and detention of Sheikh Zazaki were illegal and unconstitutional, declaring that the rights of the Islamic cleric have been violated. Despite this historic ruling of the federal court, Sheikh Zazaki and his wife have remained in detention.
4 years of misrule, 4 years of disrespect to the Nigerian constitution, 4 years into tyranny, 4 years of tyranny, 4 years of disrespect to Nigerian law, 4 years of disregard to the Nigerian constitution, 4 years to a democracy without rule of law, 4 years to a democracy that has no respect whatsoever to courts in Nigeria.
In December 2015, following a traffic incident, soldiers of the Nigerian army attacked Zazaki's home and worship center, killing over 340 of his supporters, setting the house ablaze and destroying his property. Three of his sons were among those killed during the attack. Despite several protests in Nigeria and abroad demanding for the release of Sheikh Al-Zazaki and his wife, the Nigerian government has kept a deaf ear. Instead, security operatives have continued to crack down on members of the Islamic movement in Nigeria, killing dozens and injuring and arresting many of them. So far, no one has been held responsible for the Zaria massacre, where hundreds were killed.
The panel did not accuse Sheikh Zazaki of anything, and the panel recommended that the people that invaded Malam's house, the Husseinia, the Darul Rahma, should be punished. But till date, most of them are being promoted. This is unfortunate at this sanctuary.
In addition to ordering for the release of Sheikh Zazaki and his wife Zinat, the Federal High Court also ordered the government to pay the sum of 25 million naira, about $66,000 each, to the Islamic cleric and his wife. So far, the Nigerian government has not implemented any of the order of the court. Danjuma Abdullahi, Abuja.
As part of Israel's land grabbing and illegal settlement expanding policies in the occupied West Bank, Israeli media have reported that a Knesset committee member and senior Likud member Nir Barkat has presented a plan to the Knesset to further expand settlement activities in the occupied West Bank and the Jordan Valley. According to the plan, Israel needs to establish some industrial zones and expand tourism in the areas.
Nir Barkat is one of the establishment. This fanatic Zionist establishment, that they are behind this colonial project. So what he did is not, he's saying, and what he offer is not something new. It's part of the whole Zionist plan, colonial plan, that's already going on the ground. When we talk this year about 15,000 housing units that has been issued, this is double than the last year.
Barkat has also announced that Israel aims to settle 2 million Jewish settlers in the occupied West Bank. This comes after contacts took place between settlers and Barkat himself over the past few days. Experts say to make this available, Barkat has put a plan to tighten Israel's grip on the Palestinian lands, adding that the Israeli regime will have to approve these plans before the inauguration of the next U.S. administration on 20 January 21 to make sure they will be applied.
Israeli parties are using the remaining period of Trump administration to carry out an ethnic cleansing project, first in Jerusalem Al-Quds and then in the occupied West Bank. Tel Aviv wants to restrict Palestinians in their villages and at the same time to control their surrounding areas without official declaration of annexation.
During the four-year period of U.S. President Donald Trump, settlement activity has more than doubled, as the number of plans approved by Netanyahu's regime increased 2.5 times compared to the previous 4 years. For years, Israeli authorities have continued to facilitate the expansion of illegal settlements in Palestinian territories. Tel Aviv has done everything possible to minimize the Palestinian population. Experts say what Israel is doing is annexation of Palestinian lands without official declaration. Mona Kandil, in front of the Israeli settlement of Beit Il, occupied Ramallah.
The number of coronavirus infections is on the rise in Gaza. Infections have spiked to nearly 22,000 cases since March. Daily hospitalizations due to COVID-19 also continue to rise, bringing the average of serious and critical cases to more than 20% of confirmed cases. Some 2 million Palestinians in Gaza are at the increasing risk of contracting the virus amid a severely depleted healthcare system, which is largely attributable to the Israeli regime's ongoing blockade.
The growing number of infections is exerting a lot of pressure on our health system, which is already in a bad shape because of Israel's blockade. The health sector